Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Months away from the lawmaking session, Florida already faces a budget crunch, and lawmakers are looking for cuts to get the long-term budget outlook back in the black.
We have to cut roughly $1.2, $1.3, $1.4 billion. That's going to be scenario A. That's the easy one.
Also this week, could there be a brighter future for Florida's Bright Future Scholars?
If legislature could somehow tackle either opening up more funding for education or help for those students that need it, that would be something that'd be nice to have happen.
We'll also get the latest on the line of duty deaths of two Orlando law officers early this week. I'm Tom Flanagan. Welcome to Capitol Report. The Florida legislature faces the difficult task of funding the country's third largest state on a shoestring. Nick Evans reports lawmakers are putting their noses to the grindstone.
Budget forecasts suggest there will be about $7 million in new money for lawmakers to work with this year, which, in a roughly $80 billion spending plan, is almost nothing. And House Budget Chief Carlos Trujillo says that's just the beginning.
This much red is sobering. Though we're flat for the upcoming year, when you look at the multi-year outlook, things get pretty bad pretty quickly. Unless we take action, we'll be facing a $1.3 billion shortfall in 2018-2019 and a $1.9 billion shortfall in the ensuing years. Members, that is very, very, very concerning.
To get a handle on the problem, he's tasking each of his subcommittee chairs with developing a list of hypothetical cuts. Under the exercise, lawmakers do fund a number of new issues, but they also cut more than they add to the bottom line.
So if we're adding roughly $300 million plus an additional $100 million plus an additional $250 million, we're adding about $600 million. In order for us to reach that outfall, we have to cut roughly $1.2, $1.3, $1.4 billion. That's going to be scenario A. That's the easy one.
Under scenario B, the cuts are more than $2.2 billion. Wednesday, Sanford Republican Representative Jason Broder went over the benchmarks with his committee. The Healthcare Appropriations Panel faces the largest cuts in both exercises.
One will be a slightly easier target, and for us, that is a target reduction of $275.8 million out of our budget. We don't yet know what reality we'll be facing, which is why we're doing the two of them. The more difficult target will be to reduce our budget by $573.8 million.
But with Governor Rick Scott trumpeting Florida's recovery at every turn, some lawmakers like Democratic leader Janet Cruz are scratching their heads.
What I'm seeing in my district is more housing starts than I've ever seen. I see Tampa with tourism at an all-time high. And I worry, I feel like what you're saying to me and to us is that we're looking at conceivably an economic downturn.
In response, Trujillo echoes the House leadership line. Florida doesn't have a revenue problem, it has a spending problem. But they're different sides of the same coin. And Miami Democratic Representative David Richardson wonders if the legislature has focused too heavily in recent years on a particular kind of spending.
I've been here 4 years now, and we've made significant tax cuts over the last 4 years. And I wonder how much of those tax cuts are causing us to be in the position we are now.
Whether Trujillo's exercise yields instructive results will come next month when the Appropriations Committee reconvenes. But in terms of context, Clearwater Republican Senator Jack Latvala says, although grim, the current budget picture is really nothing new.
That's our chore of trying to make value judgments of what's the most important for the people we represent. And there's never, in all, this is my 15th session, there's never been a year when we had too much money that we didn't have to make some tough decisions. And this year will be just the same.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Well, that's the bad fiscal news out of the Capitol this week, but there could also be some good news, at least for some. Specifically, the future could get a bit brighter for some Florida college students. There's a growing consensus to increase awards for some of the state's highest academic performers. Lynn Hatter reports legislative and state leaders seem to be of the same mind when it comes to lowering the cost of higher education.
Cody Taggart majors in economics at Florida State University. He's a junior, and he pays for school largely through Florida's Bright Futures tuition scholarship, along with a prepaid scholarship. Between the two, he does not have any student loans, and he knows he's lucky.
It's helped me with school because I don't have debt at all, which is something that a lot of students aren't able to go through or aren't able to have.
Taggart says he'd be happy to see plans to help those other students cut down on their overall debt load. Even with a myriad of fee waivers, scholarships, and grants, many Florida students are still leaving college with thousands of dollars in loans.
I know a lot of people that I know do have, you know, sizable debt from college, even with help from friends and family. So if legislature could somehow tackle either opening up more funding for education or help for those students that need it and want to go to college and show the initiative and the drive to be able to do it, that would be something that'd be nice to have happen.
Student loan debt is having a big impact on the economy. According to one study, students are delaying major purchases like a home or a car. And a whopping 73% of those surveyed say they've delayed saving for retirement. Help could be on the way. Governor Rick Scott and Senate President Joe Negron have introduced similar yet different plans to bring down school costs and help students accelerate to graduation. The Senate's ideas are now in what the chamber is calling the Excellence in Higher Education Act. The plan would give students who earn the top-tier Bright Futures scholarship a full ride, along with a $300 textbook stipend. That award would also cover summer courses, and other state-based financial aid programs would be increased. Scott's plan would allow all levels of Bright Futures scholarships to cover summer tuition, and the governor wants textbooks to be tax-free. He's also calling for fee freezes.
We've got to figure out a way to provide a high-quality education, but at a price that our students can afford and their parents can afford.
Such plans, says House Speaker Richard Corcoran, are overdue. In an interview with the Florida Channel, Corcoran says he's excited by what he sees coming from the governor and the Senate, and he's endorsing another idea: block tuition for students.
If you want to take 15 credit hours, that'll cost you the exact same amount as 12 credit hours. So now the kids are thinking, wait a second, I can take 15 credit hours for the same price as 12. Mm-hmm. Now they'll take 15. Again, they graduate sooner, they're out in the marketplace sooner. These are all great ideas. The governor's talking about capping fees and all of those ideas that, you know, I think they're going to find a receptive audience in the House.
But even with lawmakers in agreement on policy, they'll still have to figure out how to fund their ideas. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a fiery debate about what drives the economy is spurring state lawmakers to reevaluate the budget. The fate of some economic development programs, the backbone of Governor Scott's job efforts, could hang in the balance.
Those businesses have created over 1.25 million new jobs, and economic development on that scale does not happen without an investment.
A court case on local gun regulation may be turning into a fight about home rule.
The state law basically says you cannot regulate guns at all. Our local ordinance says you cannot fire a gun in a city park.
Another tragedy in Orlando is two law officers die in the line of duty.
Police say about 1,000 tips have come in for the whereabouts of the suspect, Markeith Lloyd.
The Southern Poverty Law Center reports a spike in hate-related incidents after the election of Donald Trump, but the available numbers don't show the human faces behind them.
It's being conscious of an environment that is potentially hostile, and I was not aware of it.
And a plan from Florida's Senate president to spend nearly $2.5 billion to protect South Florida from another algae slime attack is already under fire in the legislature.
The integrated delivery schedule is not scripture. It can be amended, and I know the Corps is prepared to do that. It's always a question of how much money do you have?
A philosophical debate is taking shape in the Florida Capitol about what role the government should play in the economy. Kate Payne reports how lawmakers come down on economic development programs could have real consequences for Governor Rick Scott's top priorities.
When you think of state lawmakers, philosophical probably isn't the first word that comes to mind. But Speaker of the House Richard Corcoran is changing that. It all boils down to a fundamental question. What makes a strong economy? The state hands over millions of tax dollars to public-private partnerships designed to jumpstart the economy. Corcoran is eyeing those programs and questioning whether they should exist at all. Take Visit Florida, the state's tourism promoter, which recently came under fire for its handling of a secret million-dollar contract with the rapper Pitbull. Roger Dow heads the U.S. Travel Association, and he defends tourism marketing.
We've got evidence state after state that have cut budgets, quickly begin to lose market share, lose jobs, lose economy as a factor of 10, 20, and 30 of what they cut.
But Corcoran says people don't come to Florida because of a TV commercial.
It's really driven by the economy and people. When they're doing well and they have extra money, they're taking their kids to Disney World. When they don't, they stay home.
So, how can the state bolster the economy? That's where Enterprise Florida comes in. It's the state's main business recruiter, which sometimes turns to economic incentives to seal a deal. It's that practice of handing money to outside businesses that's attracting most of the heat. But Sissy Proctor says the post-recession recovery didn't happen by itself. She heads the Department of Economic Opportunity.
Private sector businesses lost over 900,000 jobs. In the past 5 years, those businesses have created over 1.25 million new jobs. And economic development on that scale does not happen without without an investment.
Corcoran calls the practice corporate welfare and says it gives certain companies an unfair advantage. And Sean Cantor agrees. He's an economics professor at Florida State University.
Politicians do a really, and bureaucrats and professors do a really bad job picking winners and losers. The market does a much better job.
But outside of academia, proponents say incentives can make a difference for local economies. Kelly Smallridge at the Palm Beach County Business Development Board sees them as a bargaining tool.
And while incentives don't make or break the deal, they tip the scale in our favor. And in that particular situation, we would use an incentive to address our location weakness.
But Florida's chief economist Amy Baker points out, with an economy this size, scrambling for a few jobs here and there isn't effective statewide.
8.5 million workers in Florida, trying to attract a worker at a time would be very onerous task.
Baker and Professor Sean Cantor agree. Research and development, education, and infrastructure build a robust economy, not incentives.
When you look at surveys of corporate chiefs about their decisions to relocate, way down low is kind of the small giveaways that legislatures often do. They're interested, businesses are more interested in the fundamentals of the economy. And so I would just implore you to focus on those sorts of things.
Corcoran, for his part, seems to have already made up his mind. Last year, he led the charge to block Governor Rick Scott's request for $250 million in economic incentives, undercutting Scott's job creation plan. And Corcoran's philosophy hasn't changed much since then. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Home rule is based on the idea that the government closest to the people is the best government. Members of the Constitutional Revision Commission added that idea to the state's constitution back in 1968. But since then, Regan McCarthy reports state lawmakers have been slowly taking that power back, and this year is no exception.
Two questions are before a panel of judges in the First District Court of Appeal. Whether Tallahassee City Commission broke the law when it refused to repeal a pair of local gun ordinances, and whether the law in question is constitutional.
The state law basically says you cannot regulate guns at all. Our local ordinance says you cannot fire a gun in a city park.
That's Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum. He says the state legislation preempting local firearm ordinances sets up an onerous penalty scheme for local government officials who violate it, opening them up to lawsuits.
And I think critically, that we could be removed from office at the discretion of the governor. Those were severe overreaches, and we're making the case that they're also unconstitutional.
And while the legislation Gillum is fighting in court deals with guns, he's worried lawmakers won't stop there.
We don't know the limits of where the legislature will take this super preemption. The fact that they have included these kinds of draconian penalties, and I don't believe that they believe they're constitutional. I believe this was a tactic to send a chilling effect down through this state, through local governments, don't touch it. Don't touch this. And who else is to say what else they will tell us not to touch?
Florida lawmakers have been chipping away at the home rule authorities afforded to local governments for years. Scott Dudley is the legislative director of the Florida League of Cities. He says home rule is one of the main issues his organization deals with before the legislature. Since 2010, he says lawmakers have passed more than 36 bills removing or impacting a local government's home rule authority.
So building codes, there was some language in a building codes. Local governments are prohibited from requiring payment of any polystyrene. So we are preempted from having any regulation of the sale of plastic bags. We can't adopt any regulation with respect to the use of plastic. We've been preempted from adopting ordinances dealing with beekeeping.
The Florida Constitution gives local governments the right to govern when it comes to issues concerning the health and welfare of their citizens. And Dudley says on many of those issues, like beekeeping, it seems clear citizen health and welfare is at stake. But state lawmakers have the right to preempt those local rules. And that's something Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley says must be given careful consideration.
There are certain circumstances when preemption is appropriate just for the greater good in the economy of the state. And so, you know, it's just a case-by-case analysis.
In his other job, Bradley is a lawyer who often represents local governments. He says he understands the careful balance needed when deciding whether a measure merits local preemption. He also says he doesn't start getting too worried about it until a bill proves it has a good chance to pass. But Gillum isn't waiting. He's launching a campaign now to push back against preemption amid speculation that he's weighing a statewide campaign. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
The city of Orlando just cannot seem to catch a break. A manhunt has been underway for the suspect in a deadly shooting of an Orlando police officer all this week. And that search is underway as the city and the city's police department prepare to pay their last respects to the fallen officer this weekend. And joining us with the latest is WMFA News Director Catherine Welch. Thank you, Catherine, so much for joining us. And let's just start at the beginning here. What happened early Monday morning that led to the death of not only the police officer, but also a follow-up fatality, the death of an Orange County Sheriff's deputy?
Orlando Police Chief John Mina says Master Sergeant Deborah Clayton, she was at a Walmart Monday morning when a citizen pointed out to her a man by the name of Mark Keith Lloyd as the suspect in the death last month of Lloyd's pregnant ex-girlfriend. Officer Clayton yelled out to Lloyd to stop, and then gunfire was exchanged. The first responding officer started CPR on Clayton, and she was taken to Orlando Regional Medical Center where she was pronounced dead within the hour. Police say Officer Clayton was wearing protective body armor, and they recently discovered some of the clothing of the suspect and announced that he was also wearing a bulletproof vest. Now, responding to the call to find the suspect that Monday morning was Orange County Sheriff's Deputy Norman Lewis. He was on a motorcycle when he was killed in a traffic accident on his way to help with the search.
Certainly a double tragedy, Catherine. How's the community reacting to all this?
Both Officer Clayton and Deputy Lewis have GoFundMe accounts to help the families, and both of those accounts have raised tens of thousands of dollars. On Friday afternoon, the body of Officer Clayton, it passed by the Orlando Police Headquarters, and scores of people lined the streets to honor her as that procession went by. There's a patrol car parked outside police headquarters. It's covered in flowers and wreaths, and people have come from all over Central Florida to add items, flowers, stuffed animals to a memorial. It went up outside the Walmart where she was killed, and I interviewed one member of a local Central Florida police department. He drove more than an hour to take a badge that was on one of his uniforms and put it at the cross to honor Officer Clayton.
Catherine, it seems as though it was just a matter of weeks ago that the community had to grapple with the Pulse nightclub shooting, which actually took place last June, the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history. So how has that influenced what you've been seeing in Orlando just this past week?
the city and the county's mayor. Both of those mayors at one of the first press conferences sort of referenced the Pulse nightclub shooting in a sense that they referenced that we are Orlando strong. We know how to pull together. We've been through tragedy before. We will get through this.
One of the most profound impacts that can occur to a law enforcement agency is for one of their own members to be killed in the line of duty. And now you have two officers who have died in the Orlando area here in the past week, Catherine. Has any of this changed the dynamic between local law enforcement and the public?
If past is prologue, I think there will be a huge outpouring of support for police. That's what happened after the Pulse nightclub shooting back in June. People were thanking them for their service. I also think, too, because we have gotten to know more about the lives of Officer Clayton and Deputy Lewis, I suspect that they've humanized, in a way, their departments and perhaps served as a very sad reminder that law enforcement, members of law enforcement, they risk their lives every day on the job.
Deepest sympathies to the officers and their families and the entire community there in the Orlando area. Catherine Welch, News Director at WMFE in Orlando. Thanks, Catherine.
My pleasure.
Many people considered the rhetoric during the 2016 campaign cycle brutal. After voters elected Donald Trump as president, the Southern Poverty Law Center reported more than 1,000 hate incidents of white nationalism and harassment of minority groups, as we hear from Sarah Mueller.
Tallahassee father Adil Attari says he's worried about his kids. He recently comforted his 7-year-old daughter after she was one of two classmates not to vote for Trump in a mock election. His son Omar seems almost numb about the comments he gets at school because of the family's Muslim religion.
It's being conscious of an environment that is potentially hostile, and I was not aware of it.
Attari says he feels scared, something he's never felt before in 20 years living in the U.S. He says his family no longer feels safe in their community or in their country. Just last month, bomb threats were called into Jewish community centers in Miami-Dade, Orlando, and Jacksonville. Someone scrawled racist graffiti on a bathroom wall at a high school in Seminole County, which also referenced Trump. The Southern Poverty Law Center says more than a third of incidents it tracked right after the election directly referenced Trump. Of those, most were attacks against women. There's a big difference between a hate incident and a hate crime. A hate crime is when someone violates the law and selects the victim based on a bias towards them, like race, ethnicity, or disability. And federal reports say, as of 2012, there's an uptick in victims saying they were attacked for their religion, ethnicity, or gender.
If you look at the four people that organized this event, they're four women, four feminists. I'm not going to say that they're lesbians. There's no problem with that.
Jacksonville resident Trump supporter Gary Snow showed up in Tallahassee last month to protest an anti-Trump rally before the state electors voted. He says the liberal women who supported Hillary Clinton are the ones attacking people.
I've seen this same thing over and over again, this anti-man, this anti, especially a white man.
Mark Podock with the Southern Poverty Law Center pushes back on assertions by conservatives who say they doubt that the hate incidents are true or a result of Trump's rhetoric.
The fact that the numbers were enormous on the day after the election and dropped by about 5% for each of the succeeding 10 days or so shows that that's not so. This is not just some random spike. This was clearly related to the election.
But tracking hate crimes is tricky and badly flawed. Many times, victims don't report them to police. State law enforcement agencies report hate crimes to the FBI, but the agencies report inconsistently. Local police departments, like the Tallahassee Police Department, say they categorize crimes like a vandal spray-painting KKK on another person's property as criminal mischief. Potok says the FBI's data is worthless, but the Bureau of Justice Statistic numbers from 2012 show there's likely hundreds of thousands of violent and property hate crimes occurring every year. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, this week, we started the Capitol Report this week with a budget story. That's also how we're wrapping up the week. State Senate President Joe Negron's $2.4 billion plan to protect South Florida waterways from another toxic algae sliming received a lukewarm legislative debut. Below the radar, Jim Ash tells us, the South Florida Water Management District was launching torpedoes.
This summer, toxic green algae coated beaches and waterways in southwest and southeast Florida, including the Treasure Coast district of Senate President Joe Negron. Soon, Negron was calling for buying 60,000 acres of land south of Lake Okeechobee to store polluted runoff blamed for the outbreak. But at a Senate hearing this week, a skeptical South Florida Water Management District Executive Director, Pete Antonacci, warned storing water is just the first step.
Every time that you store water, whether it's south of the lake or north of the lake, you have to take consideration of whether it can be cleaned properly or not, because we're operating under a series of agreements with federal authorities.
Antonacci also made oblique references to the unwillingness of big sugar growers to sell productive land. However, Antonacci acknowledged water managers could always build the reservoir by speeding up an ongoing $10 billion Everglades restoration plan with the federal government.
The integrated delivery schedule is not scripture. It can be amended, and I know the Corps is prepared to do that. It's always a question of how much money do you have.
After the meeting, Antonacci said he doesn't think the state needs to buy more land to accomplish Negron's goal. A Water Management District Bureau chief was more blunt in a January 9th letter to Everglades Foundation Program Director Thomas Van Lent. The Bureau chief called an Everglades Foundation study supporting the reservoir irresponsible science and accused Van Lent of deliberately misleading the public. Van Lent stands by his report. He says the letter is a sign of how badly bureaucrats and Big Sugar want to kill the proposal.
I think they've made a determination that they're not interested in selling their land, and therefore they're curtailing even the conversation of whether or not it's a good idea. And the Water Management District seems to be taking that same view, that they want to discuss it.
Governor Rick Scott wants to focus more on encouraging the removal of septic tanks in and around the affected estuaries. Negron's plan would require bonding a $100 million stream of Amendment 1 tax dollars voters ordered set aside for land conservation in 2014. But last month, Scott blessed a report by the State Division of Bond Finance that warned against borrowing more money for land conservation. Earlier this week, Scott's top environmental cop, Department of Environmental Protection Secretary John Steverson, didn't exactly give the plan a full-throated endorsement.
I think he's going to present that plan to the Senate and to the House and work through that, and we're obviously fully committed on Everglades restoration.
House leaders could be another significant roadblock. Spending Chairman Carlos Trujillo of Miami is skeptical about buying more land. Meanwhile, Speaker Richard Corcoran has ordered all appropriations chairs to conduct a massive budget-cutting exercise. The atmosphere was particularly glum at the first meeting of the Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Subcommittee. Chairman Ben Albritton, a Bartow Republican, warned budget cuts could be steep.
Target B in recurring is $66.8 million. The non-recurring would be $28.7 million, and the total is $95.4 million. So you can see those are real numbers.
Negron supporters counter that not acting is more expensive. They cite a Florida Association of Realtors study that blamed the toxic algae bloom for $1 billion in lost property values alone. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport, and please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.